Okay, so today we're really diving deep. We're looking at this pretty wild case from 2006.
Oh, yeah, this one's a doozy.
The collapse of the hedge fund Amaranth LLC and the whole legal battle they had with JPMorgan Chase.
A $1 billion lawsuit. It's fascinating.
Yeah, we're talking high stakes finance, Wall Street deals going wrong, and then it all spills over into this huge legal fight.
That's a drama.
Yeah, and we like to get into the nitty-gritty. So we've been going through all these documents, case briefs, analyses, even some advice for podcasters just to really break this down for everyone.
Yeah, got to do your research.
Right. And especially for, anyone out there who's studying law or interested in, the business world.
Absolutely. This case is like a textbook example of how contracts, torts, all that stuff plays out in the real world.
Right. So let's just get straight into it. Amaranth was this hedge fund. They were heavily invested in natural gas derivatives.
And things went south.
Yeah, like a huge downturn. And to try and, salvage something, they were trying to make these deals first with Goldman Sachs and then with Citadel to basically offload these risky positions they were holding.
But both deals fell through. That's when things get really interesting, legally speaking.
Yeah, because Amaranth ends up suing JP Morgan, and they're claiming over $1 billion in losses.
Yeah, that's not small change.
Not at all. And the core of their lawsuit boils down to two main claims: breach of contract relating to that Goldman Sachs deal that fell apart, and then tortious interference, which is connected to that Citadel deal that also went bust.
And this is where it gets a bit complex because JP Morgan wasn't just like one single entity in all of this.
Right. So we're talking about JPMFI, so that's JP Morgan Futures Inc. They were acting as Amaranth's clearing broker, so basically handling all those, nuts and bolts of their
The
trades.
mechanics of it all.
Right. And then you've got JPMB, so that's JPMorgan Chase Bank, the big one, and they were providing financing to Amaranth for all their different investments.
Separate roles, separate legal obligations.
Yeah.
It's key to keep them straight.
So, okay, let's start with that first deal, the one with Goldman Sachs. Amaranth, they were trying to transfer a bunch of their risky positions over to Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, to get them off their books.
Exactly. But the deal was dependent on Amaranth getting this massive amount of money, like $1.85 billion, released from their account with JPMF,
Margin funds, yeah.
right, margin funds. And JPMFI said, nope.
And boom, lawsuit.
Yeah, because Amaranth was saying, hey, according to our client agreement with you guys, you have to release those funds.
Their argument was that it was a breach of contract for JPMFI to block the deal like that.
And here's where it gets interesting for law students. The court, they looked at the actual language of that client agreement.
Courts really love dissecting contracts.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, when you have these sophisticated parties, like major financial institutions, courts tend to give a lot of weight to the contracts they've signed.
Freedom of contract. They made the deal, they got to stick to it.
And in this case, the court sided with JPMFI. They pointed to specific clauses in that agreement that basically allowed JPMFI to refuse any transaction if they thought reasonably that it would increase their risk.
And they argued that releasing that amount of money, $1.85 billion, overnight, it was just too risky. They called it overnight settlement risk.
Right, so they're worried about the funds not being settled by the next day, and then boom, they're exposed.
And the court billing.
Yeah.
So, big takeaway for anyone in law school, even if a deal might look good for the client in the long run, even if it might even reduce the broker's risk eventually, if there are clear clauses in the contract about who takes what risk, the courts are going to enforce those clauses.
Especially when we're talking about, big financial
Yeah,
players.
they're supposed to know what they're signing.
Right, they have lawyers for that.
Yeah.
So next up, we've got the second deal, the one with Citadel. This is where the tortious interference claim comes in. After that Goldman Sachs deal fell apart, Amaranth started talking to Citadel about a similar transaction.
Same idea, different player.
Right. But this time, Amaranth claimed that JP Morgan didn't just let the deal fail, they actually sabotaged it.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, they were claiming that some JP Morgan executives, they were making these defamatory statements to Citadel. And the big one, the most damaging one, was that Amaranth was insolvent.
Basically saying they were going bankrupt.
Exactly. And that scared Citadel off. They pulled out of the deal. And that's what Amaranth was saying caused them to lose over $1 billion.
Yeah, that insolvency accusation, that's a killer in the financial world.
So let's break down this tortious interference thing, because the court initially dismissed this claim, but then they brought it back. Why? Let's look at what you need to prove this in New York. First, you got to show that there was a business relationship between the plaintiff, so that's Amaranth, and a third party, which is Citadel.
Right. And it doesn't even have to be a formal contract. It can be like a potential deal that was likely to happen.
Right, a prospective economic advantage. And in this case, Amaranth and Citadel, they were pretty far along in their negotiations, so that part was clear.
They were close to a deal, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, second element. You got to show that the defendant, J.P. Morgan, they knew about this relationship between Amaranth and Citadel.
Which, given how these big financial players operate, it's pretty safe to assume they did.
Right. They're all watching each other. Now, the third part, this is where it gets tricky. You got to show that the defendant interfered with that relationship, and not just interfered, but interfered through what's called improper means.
Yeah, and improper means, that's a legal term. Okay. It's not just like playing hardball in business. It has to be something that's considered wrong in itself.
And this is where those defamatory statements come back into play. Amaranth was arguing that those false statements about their solvency, that was the improper means. That's how J.P. Morgan messed up their deal with Citadel.
And the court agreed that, yeah, telling another company that your competitor is about to go bankrupt when it's not true, that could definitely count as improper means.
Especially because it was a statement about their solvency. That's not an opinion. That's a fact you can prove or disprove.
Exactly. And if it's false and it causes financial harm, well, you're in trouble.
Okay, last element of tortious interference. You got to show causation. Basically, Amaranth had to convince the court that J.P. Morgan's interference, those defamatory statements, were the direct cause of Citadel backing out and Amaranth losing all that money.
Right. It can't just be a coincidence.
And that billion-dollar figure, that's where that comes in. That's the potential damages.
Now, what's really interesting here is why the court decided to bring that tortious interference claim back. They were focusing on the idea that when you attack a company's basic integrity, their creditworthiness, that's a big deal.
Right, like accusing them of being insolvent. And the court was basically saying that kind of statement can be enough to win a tortious interference case, especially if it's false and it causes real damage.
They were saying it goes to the heart of a company's ability to do business.
And there's this concept in defamation law called defamation per se. Basically, when the statement is so damaging to a company's reputation, you don't even have to prove exactly how it hurt you in every instance.
Right, the damage is kind of assumed.
So Amaranth, they didn't have to show, like, specific instances of people not doing business with them because of the rumors. Just the fact that J.P. Morgan was spreading this idea that they were insolvent, that was enough for the court to say, yeah, that probably hurt their reputation.
Right. That kind of statement can poison the well.
Now, there's one more little wrinkle in this case that's worth mentioning, and that's the statute of limitations.
Ah, yes, the legal deadline.
Exactly. So typically in New York, for defamation cases, you only have 1 year to file your lawsuit.
Pretty short time frame.
But in this case, they used a longer statute of limitations, 3 years, for that tortious interference claim.
Which seems a bit odd, right?
Yeah, why did they do that? Well, the court's reasoning was that the main harm Amaranth was alleging wasn't just damage to their reputation, which would usually fall under that 1 year defamation limit. It was more about the economic loss, the money they lost because the Citadel deal fell apart.
It was about that $1 billion.
Exactly. So because the primary injury was economic, they applied this longer 3 year statute of limitations that's usually used for tortious interference claims. And this is a big lesson for any future lawyers out there. How you frame your legal argument, what you say the real harm is, it can make a difference in terms of deadlines and which laws apply.
Absolutely. It's all about the strategy.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about tortious interference. Let's go back to JPMFI for a second. Their role as the clearing broker and this concept of clearing broker immunity.
Yeah, we touched on that a bit earlier.
Right. So the general idea is that clearing brokers, when they're doing their normal job, you know, managing those margin accounts, processing trades, all that stuff, they usually can't be held liable for whatever their clients or other parties involved in the transactions do.
It's like they're just the middleman, making sure the gears turn.
Right. They're a necessary part of the system. And the law recognizes that and gives them some protection, unless they're acting in bad faith or doing something way outside the norm for their role.
Right. They have to be following the rules.
And that's actually why some of Amaranth's claims directly against JPMFI as the clearing broker were dismissed.
It's all about context.
Right. So those alleged defamatory statements, they weren't coming from JPMFI as the clearing broker just doing their job with the funds.
It was more about those execs at the parent company, JPMorgan Chase,
yeah,
allegedly sticking their noses where they didn't belong.
Exactly. Which brings us back to that tortious interference claim against the big JP Morgan. Not a breach of contract by JPMFI.
Different players, different rules.
So the defamatory statements, that's what the court saw as the improper means for the tortious interference claim. It's that line between what's okay, even aggressive within a contract, and what's just plain wrong and harmful in the wider business world.
Right, like you said, fair competition versus sabotage.
Okay, so let's wrap this up. We've covered a lot of ground. What are the key takeaways from this whole Amaranth versus JP Morgan saga, especially for those law students out there who are starting to learn about all this stuff?
Okay, first big takeaway, contracts matter. Those risk allocation clauses, especially in finance, you got to get them right. The court dismissed the breach of contract claim because JPMFI was just following the rules that they and Amaranth had agreed to.
Right. Even if it led to a bad outcome for Amaranth.
Yeah. Lesson learned. Read the fine print.
Okay. Second takeaway.
Don't lie about your competitors. The court reviving that tortious interference claim, that sends a strong message. You can't just go around making false statements to mess up someone else's deals, especially when you're attacking their fundamental ability to do business.
Right. Freedom of speech has its limits.
Absolutely. And remember, that defamation, it can be about more than just a hurt reputation. It can lead to real financial losses, and courts will take that seriously.
Oh, and don't forget about those statutes of limitations. They can be tricky.
Yeah, this case is a good example. How you frame your legal argument, what you say the real harm is, it can determine which deadlines apply.
So think carefully about that. And lastly, clearing brokers, they do get some protection when they're just doing their regular job.
Unless they're being shady, of course.
Right. They have to stay within the lines. Okay, so one final thought as we leave you all to ponder this case. We saw the court make a split decision. They said no to the contract claim, but yes to the tort claim.
Interesting, right?
It really makes you think.
Mm-hmm.
Financial institutions, they have all these legal rights, but what about their responsibilities? Even if they're following the letter of the law, what if their actions could really hurt their clients' business?
It's a question of ethics.
Right. Where's that line between what's legal and what's right? It's something to think about, especially in the world of finance where the stakes are so high.
Food for thought.
Definitely. Okay, that's it for this deep dive. Catch you all next time.